Some difficult words in that one, Delia. After the death of Joshua in around 1245 BC, and up until the time Saul was anointed king by Samuel in around 1050 BC, the people of Israel were led by a number of individuals we traditionally call judges. We shouldn't think that there was only ever one judge at one point in time. Far more likely there were several judges at a time who had a specific geographical area of responsibility or a specific area of life over which they judged. And the book of Judges in the Bible gives us accounts of just a few of these judges. There were undoubtedly many more of them. Depending on which scholars you trust, Deborah was a judge sometimes around 1200 or 1100 BC. 1200 is the kind of Jewish tradition, 1100 is probably the historical truth, around 1100 BC. At which time, Israel wasn't a highly developed civilization like Egypt or Assyria were. Rather, it was a hodgepodge collection of small pre-Iron Age towns and villages, loosely united in their belief in Yahweh and their origin story of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their ancestors' escape from Egypt under Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. And they weren't the sole inhabitants of this area. And they would ally with and go to war against various different groups as the need arose. As we heard a bit earlier, the Israelites were allied with the Gibeonites for a period against the Amorites. And that sort of happened throughout this period of history. Interestingly, around the time we're talking about, the name Israel starts to appear in the writings of the big civilizations like Egypt and Assyria, indicating the beginnings of a distinct political and cultural entity. And so that's the context that we find ourselves in today. The cohesion that had existed under Moses and Joshua has been somewhat eroded. And the 12 tribes of Israel are living across a large area inhabited by other tribes and peoples, and they're not necessarily taking much of an interest in each other's business. Different groups are vying for land and resources, and the much larger and much better organized nation of Canaan, ruled by King Jabin, has been oppressing Israel for 20 years. Canaan has a very large army of 900 iron chariots commanded by a man named Sisera. And the writer of Judges wants us to understand that not only was Canaan a politically strong nation, but that it had a vast army and was more technologically advanced than Israel. Canaan was an Iron Age civilization. Israel was just pre-Iron Age. Despite this oppression, life for the Israelites seems to be ticking along fairly normally. And in verse 4, we're introduced to Deborah, one of the judges of Israel who held court, we're told, in Ephraim. I think it's fascinating to see that the system of governance that Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, had suggested to Moses in Exodus 18 is still in place. There are still leaders of smaller groups of people as Moses established. Our reading today began with the phrase, "Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord." This phrase appears 7 times in the book of Judges. The Israelites just couldn't help themselves. In Judges chapter 5, we get Deborah's victory song, and the NIV translates verse 8 as, "God chose new leaders when war came to the city gates." However, another possible translation of verse 8, and what the NLT and the NRSV say is, when Israel chose new gods, war came to the city gates. That is the reason that Israel has been oppressed by Canaan for 20 years. They chose new gods instead of Yahweh. And certainly elsewhere in Judges and in the Old Testament, the Israelites were constantly guilty of things like idolatry, forgetting what Yahweh had done for them, trying to follow the examples of other nations, moral and social injustices, and so on. And so God allowed them to suffer the consequences of their actions. Verse 2. So the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The promises and blessings of God to the Israelites were conditional on their obedience to him. And disobedience had its consequences. The writers of the Old Testament certainly interpreted those consequences as deliberate acts of God. God sold them into the hands of Jabin. Today, as Christians, we might not believe that God deliberately wills bad things to happen to us as a result of our disobedience. But he certainly allows us to experience the consequences of our actions and disobedience. So he doesn't will those bad things to happen, but he does allow them to happen. Eventually, after 20 years of oppression, the people of Israel cried out to God. 20 years it took them. 20 years to realize that the other gods were worthless and meaningless. 20 years to realize that Yahweh, the God that they had rejected and replaced, the God of their ancestors, the God that had rescued them from Egypt, was the only true God and the only one who could actually help them. How often do people struggle for months, for years, for decades, refusing to acknowledge God? How often do people try to do life their own way and not God's way and suffer as a result? Even we Christian believers so often seem to fall into that trap. Rather than relying on God and trusting in him and his way of doing things, we take matters into our own hands. I'm reminded of the nameless woman in the Gospels who had suffered with a hemorrhage for 12 years, and all she had to do was reach out and touch Jesus and be healed. Do you need to reach out and just cry to help, cry to God for help? Do you need to reject your other gods and rely solely on the one true God? Notice that when people do cry out to God, he doesn't just click his fingers or wave a magic wand and miraculously solve the problem. He expects them to get involved with him and do some pretty risky work alongside him. Deborah, who wasn't just a judge, but was a prophet as well, shock horror, another female prophet in the Old Testament, she received a word from God and calls one of the male judges, Barak, to come and see her, summons him to come and see her, and she gives him his orders. This is what the Lord commands you. Call out 10,000 warriors from the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun, and I will give you victory over Jabin's army. What is it with weedy male leaders in the Old Testament? Firstly, we have Moses refusing to speak to Pharaoh unless he can take his brother with him. And here we have Barak refusing to go to battle unless Deborah goes with him. It appears that Deborah is the senior one out of the two of them, but she knows that as a woman, she can't lead an army. And I suspect that Barak's reluctance stems from several issues, not least the fact that they are going to have to face a numerically and technologically superior army. Furthermore, I've no doubt that given the 20 years of Israel, of evil that the Israelites have been doing, it meant that Barak had little or no faith in Yahweh. I remember as an army chaplain getting ready for a 6-month peacekeeping tour with the Scots Guards. Numerous soldiers of all ranks came up to me in the months beforehand and said, "You are coming with us, aren't you, Padre?" Or when I arrived in Estonia to take over as the Royal Welsh Battle Group chaplain and a commanding officer sought me out, came up to me, I'd only been there an hour, shook my hand, "I'm so glad to have you with us, Padre." People, especially soldiers, it seems, like to have someone who believes in God alongside them, especially when they're doing something challenging. Maybe you've had that experience yourself. "Would you pray for me? I know that God listens to you. Can you come with me? I know that God will be there if you're there." "Yes," you feel like saying, "but you can pray to God yourself. He will listen to you." Perhaps it's understandable if the person isn't a Christian, if they don't know God for themselves just yet. But Barak was an Israelite. And not just any Israelite. He was a judge with enough renown and enough respect that he could gather together an army of 10,000 from two of the tribes. And so Deborah warns him that his lack of faith, his reluctance to go without her in her role as prophet, means that the honour for the victory will go to a woman. This is his chance for glory, his chance to become a great leader in Israel. But his lack of faith means that the victory is not credited to him. The honour for the victory over Jabin and Sisera goes to Jael. Jael is a Kenite and therefore a descendant of Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, and a distant relative of Moses' wife, Zipporah. And so not only does the victory not go to an Israelite man, it doesn't go to an Israelite at all. The victory goes to a foreign woman. According to verse 14, the actual battle took the form of the Israelites ambushing the Canaanites on the slopes of Mount Tabor, which was very heavily forested. And as you may imagine, heavily forested slopes are not the ideal place for chariots to fight. And it seems that Barak's attack threw Sisera's army into a mad panic. Sisera, yet another weedy male Old Testament leader, leapt from his chariot and abandoned his army and ran away. Not the sort of leadership you expect from an army commander. And so Sisera's army pursued the retreating Canaanites and finished them off so that they posed no more threat to the Israelites. Meanwhile, Barak has fled to the homestead of Jael's husband, Heber. Heber is not there, but Jael invites Barak into her tent. Now, we're all grown-ups, and it doesn't take much imagination to realise just what Barak was hoping was going to happen. Hopefully I don't need to spell it out. First, though, he asked for water, and Jael generously gives him milk. And in Deborah's victory song, chapter 5, verse 25, we learn that it's actually yogurt or milk curds that she gives him. Here's a fact that I learned whilst researching this sermon. Goat's milk, especially goat's milk products, contains an amino acid called tryptophan, which can help induce a state of calm and relaxation. And in fact, the soporific effect of goat's milk products has been known for thousands of years. So she gives him some goat's milk yogurt and he falls asleep. Despite her husband's friendship with the Canaanites, Jael remembers the bond between the Kenites and the Israelites. And when Sisera falls asleep, she does just what any reasonable woman would be expected to do and hammers a tent peg through his head into the ground and kills him. And the honour for the defeat falls to her. I was trying to think of what lessons we can learn from the story of Deborah and Jael. Of course, beware of attractive women with a bowl of yogurt in one hand and a camping mallet in the other. But seriously, we can see that despite what some people might claim about women and leadership, God did call women to leadership in ancient Israel, as he did in the New Testament era and as he still does today. Disobedience or willful ignorance of God does have its consequences. However, even after decades of ignoring God, he will respond when we call him. For everyone who asks receives, the one who seeks finds, and to the one who knocks, the door will be opened. A really important one. God will have his way, despite us. And if we ignore a call upon our lives or a command from God, he will simply find someone else to do the work. And there is work. God doesn't often just click his fingers and make a miracle happen. Occasionally he does. But more often than not, he expects us to get stuck in with him, to do the difficult and sometimes risky work of being a disciple.